Good morning. I'm going to talk today about overcoming or freedom from two barriers to wellness. Come on in. Or we might say in the traditional language, two barriers to realization. These barriers are, you know, a traditional way of looking at things from Yogacara Buddhism. They're called afflictive emotion and delusion. Sounds like something I wouldn't mind overcoming. And any more seats in here? A couple. Come on in. So this idea of these two barriers is rooted in what's called Yogacara Buddhism. And I'm preparing to teach a class here on Yogacara Buddhism, and I've been working on a book on Yogacara Buddhism because I think Yogacara Buddhism is really good at promoting human welfare. And it's basically a school of thought that was prevalent in the first half of the first millennium. And then it sort of like quieted down as a school. But what it did is it left traces throughout Buddhism. And because Buddhism influences human culture, left traces throughout human culture. So, and Yogacara's emphasis really is on finding a way to harmonize early Buddhist thought with later Mahayana Buddhist thought, which some of you would be like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And some of you know exactly what I'm talking about. I'm not going to elaborate much. But the first Buddhist teachings are really quite different from later ones, and they're certainly quite different than traditional Zen ones. And in general, I would say that early Buddhist thought is characterized by being focused on psychology. So observing the emotional and volitional energy of the mind, and just by observing it, principally, letting go of the tendencies we have that cause harm to us, that are painful for us, and that cause us to do harm to other people. So this is called afflictive emotion. So the Yogacara said, okay, that's afflictive emotion. This early Buddhist teachings are really good at dealing with that. And then they looked at Mahayana teachings, which are, they said, focus on dealing with the problem of delusion. Basically, the delusion that we know something. If we think we know something, what we have done is we've taken a piece of the universe, separated it from everything else, and said it's different and independent. This is fundamentally not true, according to Mahayana teachings. And so whenever we have taken something and said, this is its own separate thing, we're involved in delusion. So when we think, I am separate from the rest of the universe, we're involved in delusion. You might think, well, that's a weird thing to think. The reason that these teachings exist is that feeling we're separate from the universe is the root of our tendency to feel alone, to feel alienated, to feel selfish, to feel angry. So Mahayana teachings try and go to the root of how we construct suffering habitually through consciousness patterns. So anyway, Yogacara says, we think these early psychological teachings are really good at dealing with afflictive emotion. We'll call that one barrier. And we think Mahayana teachings are really good at dealing with the what we'll call the barrier of delusion. And we're just going to try and find a way to incorporate all these teachings. Now, the thing is, here at MCMC, if you've been here for a little while, you might think, well, but we already do all this stuff. That's because, arguably, this is a very Yogacara center of practice. You can go to Zen practice centers where there's very little talk about psychology or really emotional energy. I just was talking to someone. It was quite funny. He said he had lived at a Zen practice community in the 90s, and he said, I didn't hear the word heart for 2 years. which is hard to believe if you hang out here. We're always talking about the heart. So different people do different things. Here we do have a lot of integration of a wide variety of Buddhist ideas and non-Buddhist psychological ideas and ideas from all kinds of traditions. So, just for a little fun note, if anyone here has ever heard of Thich Nhat Hanh, he's very clearly a Yogacara teacher, and he's written several books on Yogacara. And you can see his principal areas of emphasis are dealing with psychology and promoting understanding of interdependence, which is actually the basic teaching of how to deal with the two barriers in Yogacara thought. Attend to your emotional states and take care of them, and develop your capacity to realize interdependence. Because when you realize interdependence, you can let go of this delusion that things are all separate. And doing both, I think it's a good balance. That's just been my experience. You know, if I get too just wrapped up in Zen teachings that are just purely about the independence of emptiness of all phenomena, sometimes I can sort of not pay attention to my emotional energy. But those happen. And likewise, if I get really absorbed and just like, okay, keep turning this light within, I'm just going to keep looking, what's going on, man? It's like, oh, wait a minute. I forgot to look up. I forgot to see the whole. But they harmonize. And they actually work in, I guess, what you'd call a dialectic very well. Both of these really focus on letting go of trying to control external, apparently external objects. That's the way human consciousness normally works. It thinks about things, and it has a stream of cognition that's saying there's all these things, like that other guy at work who never does his job right. That's a thing. He's not really something separate from you, right? But the mind thinks it is, and then it goes, well, why did he do it? And then the mind wants to find a way to argue with the person to make them do what you want. Maybe your mind never does that, I don't know. Anyway, so there's the mind likes to do that. So it turns whatever this is into the sense that there's a subject observing objects, and then those objects are attempted to be manipulated, and it's so effective, as we all know. All those arguments we have with people, we always control them successfully, don't we?
Yes.
Yeah. Wow, she's good. The master is here. So instead of trying to control apparently external objects, we can focus on becoming intimate with our emotional energy and become intimate with our interdependence with everything in every moment. We can enter the two barriers. So, the barrier of afflictive emotion. Sounds fun. I should say emotion could also be, we might say, impulsive energy or volitional impulse. They're closely related, and sometimes they get kind of mixed up in the terminology here. So, what are we talking about when we say afflictive emotions? Sometimes you'll see the term that originally was called affliction translated as, you'll see it come up as defilement. So I think maybe there's a gata in the bathroom that says, when I shave my face, I vow with all beings to eliminate all defilement or something. So the original Sanskrit word all the way back is klesha, which would, a most direct translation from that time would be illness or affliction. So the term defilement has come through China and then Japan and then into English, and what was originally thought to be a medical problem comes out as appearing to be sort of a religious problem. I much prefer the term affliction. I don't think anyone here is defiled. It's cool. I know lots of people talk about defilement, and it's all good. But I don't want to talk about defilement. Why? Because if we talk about affliction, we're talking about suffering. We're talking about something towards which the natural response is compassion. So rather than eliminating defilements, I seek to be present to affliction. And in being present, it actually can dissolve. So here's some lists of afflictive emotions from the Abhidharma. Here's a list of some emotional components from the Abhidharma. I'll start with the beneficial because that'll seem more nice. The beneficial mental energies, faith, conscience, humility, lack of desire, lack of aversion, lack of delusion, energy, tranquility, carefulness, equanimity, and nonviolence. Yeah, we can do that. We can do that. Those happen, right? Wonderful. Afflictive emotions, afflictive impulses, desire, aversion, delusion, pride, wrong view, malice, anger, hatred, envy, selfishness, deceitfulness, guile, arrogance, harmfulness, lack of integrity, laziness, sluggishness, forgetfulness, carelessness, distraction, and unawareness. Now, early yogacharans would recommend memorizing that list and then sitting, and as these things come up, and unawareness. How could you be aware of unawareness? That would be cool. If anyone wants to do that practice, I think it might be quite wonderful. But my doubts are strong that anyone will in this room, so that's okay. But what it points to is that we can see, there's some stuff that happens in terms of emotional energy or impulse that's helpful, and there's stuff that isn't. And in the early Buddhist model, we have the Eightfold Path. The last three components of the Eightfold Path have to do with working with mind. Right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. So right effort is very specifically, every time it's elucidated in the Pali Canon, about having putting your effort into having what is in the mind be beneficial rather than harmful. And, you know, it is actually possible, I think, that sometimes, you know, I'll be like, why is he still doing that? And I'll realize, oh, that is not a beneficial emotion I'm experiencing. I'm just going to let that go. And sometimes that actually works. Oh, about 4% of the time. But that's okay. This is a manifestation of right effort, which is all right. It's okay to just stop and say, you know what? I don't need to go there. Now, generally speaking, this is really de-emphasized in this tradition, so we're not really looking at just being like, I'm just going to go in and control my mind, because we've just made the mind into an object, which is apparently external, that we're going to try and control. However, having said that, it's okay. If it's not going to be harmful to yourself and the emotional energy isn't too strong, you might just be able to say, you know what, I'm just going to not do that. I've done that enough times. One of my friends was just going through experiencing some, she started talking a lot of negative self-talk, and I was just listening, and then she said, why am I eating worms? You know, she just said, I think I'm done with this line of reasoning. So we can do that. But generally speaking, the method that's recommended in this tradition for manifesting right effort, how we put our energy into having the mind be one which contains beneficial rather than harmful or painful states, is mindfulness. So just being attentive to the emotional state is liberative. And I'm not going to talk about that a whole lot. I think anyone who's done it knows. And if you haven't, you can try it and find out. But This is about being intimate with our own emotional state. And this just is not generally the way we want to do things, right? You know, or I don't. Be like, you're wrong. But, you know, as I begin to get better, instead of saying you're wrong, and instead saying I feel angry, I feel more close to people and I feel more close to myself. Well, this turning the energy inward to actually attending to our emotional states instead of just following our line of reasoning is quite powerful. And so we don't really recommend this traditional Yogacara Abhidharma practice of having our big list of emotions and naming them as they come up. We just seem to talk around here about when we practice meditation, it is often the case that we become more intimate with how we feel. It's just a natural process, because if you are concentrating on the breathing, which is what many of us do here, if you're concentrating on the breathing, there will be some occasional, albeit perhaps brief, lapses in the steady stream of cognition that runs through the human mind. And in that space, as we taste and touch the experience of the body, we realize that the locus of our emotions is very much in the body, and we become intimate with how we feel. So this is about intimacy. The barrier is not something that we break through, but something which we enter. And you can do this type of thing just, you know, at work. As you see the mind starting to generate something about how, why isn't this project working? What's wrong with this stupid computer? Why are these so slow? Has anyone ever thought, why is my computer so slow? Because 20 years ago, none of us even had them. Like people complaining that they can't get their instructions off their iPhone. It's like, how fast do we go from seeing a miracle to being dissatisfied with it not doing what we want it to do? Incredible. So we can just stop when we're dissatisfied and turn the light within, turn the lamp to shine within, and taste our emotions in the body. Turn the light within. Sometimes people recommend taking 3 mindful breaths. A lot of room in there. There's a poem from the Theragata, which is a collection of teachings from the first Buddhist women. And I'll just read a poem from a woman named Dhamma. She was very, very old and infirm. She'd been practicing for quite some time. She says, I wandered for alms, leaning on a stick and weak, with trembling limbs. Suddenly I fell down. Seeing clearly the pain of my body, my heart was freed. Freedom is not somewhere other than in afflictive emotion. She directly saw that life was difficult, and that's where she found freedom. You can also find it in joy. But it's not somewhere else. So I want to do a little thing together here. I wonder if everyone could just find a posture conducive to meditation. So if you like to sit more upright for meditation, that's cool. And let's close the eyes. Now draw the attention just into the body, perhaps with the breath as the focus of this bodily awareness. And now, without naming or judging any more than is necessary, bring the attention to whatever emotional or volitional impulse is here. And now, without thinking about it much, with just one word, name the prevailing or strongest aspect of this energy in your mind. One word. And now keep this word in your heart. And now bring your awareness to the field of hearing. And I will invite anyone who would like to say this word out loud to do so. We have a big collective mind which has room for everything, just as the mind of Zazen has room for everything. So feel free to just say whatever word describes that emotional state you noticed. Okay, just open the eyes. Oh, it's not so hard. Just come in, side. Don't need to analyze, so I'm not recommending an analytical meditation process, just so you know. This is just about being intimate, being attentive. So let me move on to the barrier of delusion. Mahayana texts, there's like a reformation essentially, or something like that, sort of a change in emphasis in Buddhism about 500 years after it came about, and there gets to be lots and lots of texts that really focus on it's called emptiness. So that means the fact that anything is not a separate lasting entity, so it's empty of separateness, or interdependence, that all things are infinitely connected, or other dependence, that each thing is merely a manifestation of everything else. So it's like, you're the universe, the only thing you aren't is you. Fun! Fun! But you see these teachings, this ideas, all the way back in the first elements of Buddhism. Mahapajapati was another one of the first Buddhist women. She's actually the first ordained Buddhist woman. And she has a pretty inspiring and amazing story, as many women who have been the first to do something have. The Theragata, which is the records of these women, is mostly poems. A lot of them have to do with their experiences of realizing enlightenment or entering nirvana, which is pretty exciting. I'll just read part of what she says here in her most famous verse. All pain is understood. The cause, the craving is dried up. The Noble Eightfold Way unfolds. I have reached the state where everything stops. I have been mother, son, father, brother, grandmother. Knowing nothing of the truth, I journeyed on. But I have seen the Buddha. So now, you, certainly in this context, part of what she's talking about is her, we have to assume from the context, I would have assumed from the context of the teachings, her series of reincarnations. She had been a mother, a son, a brother, a father, a grandmother, and she was journeying on through the cycle of rebirth. I know nothing about rebirth, except for whatever I don't know. So it's out of my field of expertise. But in terms of realizing interdependence, what she says is, I have been mother, son, father, brother, grandmother, knowing nothing of the truth, I journeyed on, but I've seen Buddha. As long as she thought she was one of these things, she was caught in the web of suffering. And once she realized that she had been them all, she was liberated. So when she realized the interdependence of her nature, rather the individuality of her nature, she realized liberation. And this is a theme that is big in Mahayana Buddhism. Sometimes you get a big book and it just says that like 450,000 times. I see a couple of people who've read these kind of books. They're smiling. You know, you try and talk about it, and after page 200 you go, whoa! But it's beautiful. Because it's a message that's, you know, you can hear it once, it might touch you, it might not. But really realizing this in a moment-to-moment way, that's not easy. We keep coming back to being like, me, my needs, it's cold, I don't want it to be cold. Well, you got 6 months, honey. Ah, here we are, together. We're in this together, my friends. So, Yogacara teachings are going to emphasize two things to deal with the barrier of delusion, mostly. I can class them as two things. One is practicing objectless meditation, and the other is thinking about interdependence or conceptualizing interdependence. So, practicing objectless meditation. Would someone please explain this? So, objectless meditation is actually a big and central theme in Soto Zen Buddhism. It's very hard to describe. I'm just going to say some things that point to it. Often it will be called just sitting. So we'll say you sit without a gaining idea. So you don't make an object of something that you're trying to do. So there's not an object in that regard. And sometimes you'll get language in Zen like, just this. So mindfulness suggests observe just this. So there's an observer, an instruction to observe just this. When a Zen teacher says just this, they're not telling you to observe something. Because once you've made an observer, you've made an object. So when, if any Zen teachers say just this, good luck! But what's being pointed towards is that there's not a subject and an object. And that's already true. You may think there is one, but it's just an idea. So when we practice meditation and we have instructions like sit with no gaining idea, don't try and make something happen. As my friend Ted said at the beginning of a retreat a while ago, don't come here and send yourself out on a quest. Right? Just be here. You don't have to pick a specific object. You don't have a list of things that you're analyzing. You know, is this equanimity or tranquility? I'm not sure. Which one of the beneficial mental factors is this? Yeah, so we can just soften the tendencies of the mind to conceptualize right at the root in Zazen. Well, it's hard to talk about. It's hard to do, but it does just happen. If you keep sitting, if you just come here and sit, objectlessness occurs. Conceptualizing interdependence is easier to talk about. And this is something that if anyone's read any Thich Nhat Hanh books, you may have noticed that he is an enthusiast of conceptualizing interdependence. And it's wonderful. What if every time you went to the store and picked an object up off the shelf, you thought for 30 seconds about all the things that had to happen for that to exist? You might find yourself in line at that store with a profound feeling of gratitude and connection. And also connection to things that are harmful. Look, modern farming industrial complex is very harmful. That's okay. So we can enter not only someone had to, you know, sort these beans, and someone had to manufacture the chemicals. Or someone did. They didn't have to. Someone did manufacture the chemicals that make these beans. Someone drove a truck across the country, and someone mined up the fossil fuels that drove that truck. Someone is feeding their child with money that was gotten through the transference of these beans. So we're not just connected to everyone we're connected to everyone in ways that are completely beyond comprehension. So when you conceptualize, you're not seeing the whole thing, but at least you're making a little softening the sense of like, oh yeah, I get to have what I want. Why don't they have the kind of beans I want? Right? Good Lord. What a crazy bunch of people we are. Crazy. I wanted the Greek kalamatas, not the Italian ones. Actually, there are probably no such thing as Italian kalamatas. I mean, anyway. You can do this all you want. It ain't going to hurt. Well, I mean, I don't know. Maybe if you just sit the whole time at your desk at work and you just think about how you're interconnected with your computer, you might get in trouble. But if you do it, you know, for 10 minutes a day, it's probably going to be okay. And you might find yourself a little less caught by your selfishness, by your feeling like you know what's right. Things should go your way. So let's. I'm enjoying playing around with the group mind here. So what if we return to this posture of meditation again? And again, close the eyes. And now, if possible, just let the mind rest in what is. No particular focus. Just awareness of all the things that are happening now. Sounds, sensations in the body, thoughts. There's a broad awareness. All things everywhere are connected. That this is here right now is not separate from anything, not separate from things we like, or not separate from things we don't like. So I'd just like to invite people to say things that they realize they are connected to. Let's return to the visual field with the eyes open. Thank you, how lovely. So let me talk for a few minutes about working with the model of two barriers of affliction in my own life. Because it could appear that what we're doing is we're really, you might think, or a critique could be made that, well, we're just taking care of our emotions and then taking care of how our mind works, you know, how are we actually going to, like, help people? Because actually the reason I started doing this practice, well, I wanted to not feel horrible. But I also knew that feeling bad was in the way of my ability to be, you know, helpful in the world. And so that's, you know, for me, that's a big motivator for why I do this. So I always want to think about that a little bit. So, mass incarceration of young black men in the United States. So in case you don't know, in the last 30 years, the United States prison population has quintupled. The United States now has one of the largest per capita prison populations of any nation. It may be number one. Most statistics say it's number one. North Korea is not tracked. That prison population is wildly disproportionately represented by black men, who are incarcerated at a rate per capita 6 times that of white men, although crime statistics do not come anywhere near to reflecting that disparity. Just to give you a sense of this. Now, when I talk about this, I am feeling angry. I can feel burning in my chest. I can feel my heart rate accelerating. I can feel my mind wanting to increase its pace. I can feel constriction through all my emotional energies. So, this is the barrier of afflictive emotion. Now, my practice is to do my best to attend to when this kind of emotional energy arises and be present to it. And this helps me. Now, people will often say, and I don't. It may be true, you know. And different people's motivations are different. But they say, well, you know, my anger about social issues is what motivates me to do something, and that is cool. It's probably part of my motivation. But what I find is that this angry state, one, is painful for me, and two, tends to harden my sense of separation from things. One. And also, it tends to motivate me to do things like sit around with my girlfriend and talk at length about how this is a problem, angrily, because we can feed off each other, because we're both really interested in social justice. It does not incline me to do it, but I often see that it inclines a lot of people to post things on the internet in ways that seem to foster absolutely no connection or forward progress, although I don't know, but it seems like there's a real tendency for anger around these kind of issues. It just doesn't seem, in my experience, hasn't been helpful. And as I have focused on taking care of my own anger around such things and this issue, it has not diminished by any means the energy that I put into trying to do something about it. But what it has done is it has enabled me to suffer less, which is fine with me. I don't mind suffering less. Now, in terms of the barrier of delusion, so when this concept arises, the mass incarceration of young black men in the United States, I might think that I am separate from the mass incarceration of young black men in the United States, and that is fundamentally delusion. That's what this teaching is. I am intimately connected with the mass incarceration of young black men in the United States. That's painful. But it's real. Who could I blame? I'd love to turn this into a thing using delusion, separation, and say, that's the guy. The Democratic strategy of trying to get Southern votes by being tough on crime, which meant putting black people in prison, is why we have this problem. But that's not really why we have the problem. Has there been a problem with racism in the United States for a while? I think so. I don't know. Am I separate from the problem? I'm part of everything. I want to run away from it and push it away. I want to say, you're the problem. That's the bad guy. Those racist people are the bad guys. What are the odds that I'm not racist? Not very good. I'm a human being. We carry all kinds of stuff we don't know about. So, I can realize my connection. So connection isn't always like fuzzy rainbows. I love fuzzy rainbows. But I'm connected to this. And what does this do for me? One, instead of feeling angry now, I feel sad. I feel compassion for myself, for people who are in prison, and for the people who are caught in their ideas that make them want to put people in prison, which I don't think is a happy way to be. And I realize I have some responsibility in this. But more important than responsibility, what I feel is I have some opportunity. I have some opportunity. Since I'm part of it, that means I can do something. You know what I mean? I can't change other people's minds. I can't control other people. I can't transform the criminal justice system, I don't think. But I can make an effort. I can make a momentary effort, me, to not judge people, to not try and externalize the problem, and I can vote for people who don't promote draconian penal measures. I can vote for people who are less likely to be racist, or at least don't, you know. I can campaign, and I do. I do vote, and I do campaign. I'm not just saying I can. I do vote, and I do marginal amount of campaigning for people who I think are less likely to increase our prison population and the disparities there. And I go to prison. Well, now I go to JDC, but I go to correctional facilities, not that often, every couple months, and I meditate with people who are there. And there, I can really be intimate with my connection to the problem, because I'm just right there. I was just at JDC yesterday. This is young, bunch of young men, most of them black. Trying meditation. Amazing! Inspiring! They were frustrated. They were angry. They were confrontational. I was frustrated. There we were. It was good. It's the best I can do. I can't change anything. I can make my effort. I can make my effort and let go. So it is through the barrier or in the barrier, not a smashing of the barrier. Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. When you are in a gate, the position of boundlessness, you are inside the barrier. Enter the barrier. Directly become intimate with afflictive emotion. Directly become intimate with the mind creating delusion. And is that point of entry that boundlessness and liberation are available? Thank you for attending to my speaking. We have a few minutes where people could make observations or ask questions. And that would be lovely.
What does a fuzzy rainbow look like?
It's more of a feeling.
What was the feedback when you brought the meditation?
Well, the guys in the JDC yesterday were not. There was a white guy and a Mexican guy and four black young men, and sometimes we have women there too. I've done this. For a while now, both there and previously at a prison. And the feedback is extremely various. Extremely various. So some people are quite responsive and appreciative. Some people are sort of, you know, aversive and disruptive and confrontational. It's quite various. It's a little different than here. But ultimately, it's just, you know, you're there with people. You're there with people.
Interesting to do this practice with personal relationships. I have a tendency to judge my daughter-in-law. And if I look at her, why she takes care of her children. I think every grandmother does that. And let's keep my mouth shut. But the essence of that is independence. I saw a piece of art that she sent me, which was it was made out of a single piece of metal, a large piece of metal about 7 feet tall. And the artist had cut out the image of a human body, and that had become, number one was just the cut out, then the second piece was a human body that was cut out, and then another human body was cut out of that one, and then another, and another, and another, and another. And they all came out with the same piece of metal.
Huh.
And he lined them up with the wires. You can see the events that you made here this year. And it really brought it out to me, especially the fact that it was all made out of the same piece of metal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the way of thinking. I don't think of it in terms of past lives. I think of it in terms of just the mechanical aspects of genetic material being carried. Way back to the beginning of time, from the start, from the Big Bang. And to me, that's very powerful. And one of the things that Thich Nhat Hanh said, I was recently in a retreat, he said, he sat in front of 1,000 people with a cup of tea and said, I am drinking the clouds. And if you really think about that, you were drinking the clouds, and I had to tell you whatever it was you were drinking.
Oh, it's clouds.
But it is, I like the way you put the two together, because so often it's the sense of, there's something not quite right here when I'm being critical. And it's a feeling, not feeling right, you know, feeling that this doesn't sit well. And then putting that together with the sense of, I am a piece of, and there's no doubt that. You know, the same thing applies also to you judge others, the negative aspects of your own self.
Mm.
And that's another piece of it.
Quite true. Quite true.
When you were talking about the independence of all things, I was reminded of how a baby bear out in the woods. And it ran off, and all I could think of was how happy that it would be just to be in the woods.
Mm.
I thought it was just a peaceful feeling of having seen it, nothing happened, the thing ran off, and just a peaceful feeling of saying everything was just right then, everything was just right, because the bear was free to go to the woods, we didn't hurt anything, they didn't cut it up.
Mm.
It was just, it was pretty cool.
Mm. Lovely. Yes, nature. I recommend it. So I kind of talked for a long time, so I think we should wrap up and move to announcements. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.